Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics podcast. I'm Claire Malone. Today's special edition of the podcast is part of our When Women Run series that you can find on our website. It's an oral history of 97 women who've run for office in America and what their experiences were like. As part of the project, I traveled down to Georgia this fall to speak with Stacey Abrams, who gained national attention for her run to be the first Black female governor of Georgia. She lost the election, but made a lot of waves, and I wanted to talk to her about what it was like to campaign, not just this time around, but throughout her career. Take a listen. So I'm just gonna hop right in, as we have with a lot of people on this project, and I'm wondering if you can tell me the story of the first time you decided to run for office. Kind of what was the moment in your life, and why did you decide to run at that particular time?
I was serving as deputy city attorney for the city of Atlanta. It was the first administration in Atlanta when there was a Republican governor, and there had been a lot of changes in how the city and the state interacted. My job as deputy city attorney was to manage the team of lawyers that went to the state capitol to monitor legislation. And what I realized when I got there was that there were very few people working as legislators who had ever actually worked for city government. You had a lot of people who'd been mayors or city council members, but very few people who were bureaucrats who had to actually administer the rules they were promulgating.
Yeah.
And the disconnect between the ideas and the reality were legion.
Right.
And for me, it was helping. My job was to essentially take this information and then translate it for someone working in watershed management or someone in charge of transportation. And two things hit me. One was the realization that bureaucrats needed to be in office, because often what legislators were doing were solving problems that they understood the surface of, but they didn't understand the regulatory scheme. Like,
right.
How did you actually administer it? And I'm a tax attorney by training, so the administrative piece of things fascinates me. The second part, though, was that I knew by that point that I wanted to serve an executive role. And I realized that if I didn't understand the legislative process, I wouldn't be an effective executive in my sense, because no matter what the executive wanted, whether it was a governor or a mayor, if you didn't understand how the process of building laws happened and how you navigated that, you were going to be less effective and you weren't going to get what you wanted.
Yeah.
And I believe in practical knowledge, so I decided to run for office.
So it's interesting, a lot of the women that we've talked to for this project, they'll say, someone kind of put a bug in my ear at this certain time. And there's an interesting thing. Ben Jealous had this Facebook post, I think the night or the day of your gubernatorial primary vote, and he said, 25 years ago, Stacey Abrams told me that she was going to be the first governor of Georgia, and I believed her. And it's so interesting because one thing that it seems to have stood out for you know, reading about you and is that you knew you wanted to run for office. And what do you think it was about you?
So now I knew I was going to run for office starting in college.
Yeah.
I will correct Ben a little bit.
Okay.
What I told him was I was going to be mayor of Atlanta.
Okay.
I hadn't decided about governor, but Ben has always had higher aspirations for me. But I grew up in a family that was very committed to social justice, mm-hmm. that spent a lot of time doing direct service. The issues that animate me have always been ones, though, that I knew they couldn't solve alone. My parents and the six of us, we weren't going to solve poverty in Mississippi. But what fascinated me was the issue of who could do it, which part of the world could fix it. And government, to me, seemed to be the best able and often the least engaged in that process for, you know, from the vantage point that I had. And so I'm a bit of a self-starter, mm-hmm. and I wanted to solve it. And when I realized that as a matter of efficiency, being in charge of governmental pieces could help me get things done,
yeah.
I decided I needed to run for office.
Do you think that you're unique as a woman politician in having that kind of, I knew from a long time ago that I was going to run for office?
I don't think I'm unique. I think I would say I'm unusual, mm-hmm. because for a lot of women, the instinct is to direct service, to try to solve the problem.
Sure.
And politics is opaque and complicated, and not too complicated for women, but it's complicated to figure out how do you enter, how do you stay, how do you make change happen.
Yeah.
I've always been fascinated by the systems, and for me, this was just a system you had to understand, a system you needed to, you know, take over.
Yeah.
And so I would say that the difference for me was less that I don't wait for people to ask me to do things.
Yeah.
I tend to try to fix the problems I see.
Yeah.
And because my eye has always been focused on social justice issues, government has always seemed like one of the key solutions to the problem.
You know, you brought up your family, and actually you and I have something in common. We are both one of six siblings.
And which one are you?
I'm the youngest.
I'm number two.
Okay. And so this isn't necessarily about women in politics, but I'm sort of interested if you think there's any connection between being in a big family and the idea of running for office, or you know, because when you're a big family, it's there's a lot of community, there's lots of systems when you're living with that many people. And I'm kind of curious about that. I mean, you're close with your siblings. I'm sort of wondering what role that plays. And particularly your sister. You know, I think about the sister pairs of Kamala Harris and Maya Harris. Mm-hmm. One of your sisters is a federal judge. I mean, I'm sort of curious what impact that had.
So I'm number two of six. And when we think about sort of the taxonomy of my family, our oldest sister is the captain. I'm finance and logistics. Leslie's sort of the cruise director. And then the younger three are staff. So their responsibility is deployment. But yeah, in our family, when we were growing up, we had lots of things that we wanted to do as kids, things we were responsible for through the work my parents were doing. And yeah, for me, part of getting through a day was that we had to get six people under the age of 12 to get things done. Yeah. And so you sort of figure out where you are. My mom assigned each of us a sibling to be responsible for, so it was my younger brother, Richard. But I'm close to each of my siblings in different ways. Yeah. And so I think the macro for me was that, yes, government existed in our family. You know, there's a president and vice president. I won't talk about who held which job, but we're all afraid of my mom, if that tells you anything. But the responsibility was you had to get these things done, and there were no excuses. Right. And you did. You had to figure out which system. You had to figure out how do you utilize each player best.
Does being a girl in the family play any role? Do you think there's like a, you know, a high achieving thing, or is it just more like a?
Well, there are four girls and two boys, mm-hmm. and so it was the older three of us are all girls, and then we had two brothers and our youngest sister, and so I think for each of us, the way we experienced our family was different.
Yeah.
I, despite my current job, am an introvert, which meant that my way of navigating was different than Leslie, the judge, or Janine, she runs Fair Count. Is one of the leaders of one of the organizations I started, but she has a much more extroverted personality.
Yeah.
Andrea is the oldest and is also an introvert, but she never had to worry about it because we just did what she told us.
You know, it's funny you bring up introversion. I was going to ask you about that because you've described yourself as being a more introverted person. I'm curious, as a politician, you know, I think there's often this thing of women politicians should be chatty and extroverted. How do you deal with that? Maybe idea that people have about what you should be as a woman?
My job is to understand what people need and then figure out how I can deliver it without having to compromise who I am. So yes, I'm an introvert. I canvass because the most effective way to get people to talk to you is to go and find them. However, when I knock on the door, I pray no one is home and that they won't answer. That's my introvert. But the utility part of me says you're going to knock anyway, and I'm going to stand still when they open the door, and I'm going to talk to them.
Yeah.
I'm effective at delivering messages. I'm a pretty good speaker. But as soon as I'm done, my team knows that I'm going to need at least an hour of detox sitting in front of a television by myself without anyone bothering me.
Yeah.
And so it's organizing the way I do my politics, because I do think it's legitimate that people want to know you. They want to know that they can touch you and access you, that you care about them.
Right.
And part of what being chatty and gregarious shows is that you connect. My job, and I think the job of any introvert, especially women, it's not to hide from the opportunity, it's to figure out how do you mold what you are good at to meet the needs. Because fundamentally what people want is not that you have to be their best friend or the stand-up comedian. They want to know that you can hear them, that you care about them, and that you're a real person who will think about them when you're making choices.
Right. You've also talked about the prism of race and gender, and the way that you and your policies are viewed through that prism.
Yes.
Has that become more pronounced as you've become more well-known?
It is exceptionally well-pronounced.
Yeah.
I mean, part of it is each thing I stand for in recent years has put me in a singular category. I was the first woman, the first black woman, the first black person. I mean, each time this happens, I take on a new attribute, and you cannot miss me. I not only can you not miss me because I'm present and fairly clear about who I am and what I want, But I can't divorce any one of those aspects of myself from who I am.
Right.
And I don't want to. And my response is that instead you have to lean in and embrace it and explain why it matters. Because race does matter. Gender does matter. The intersectionality of race and gender matters. It informs how I see things, the experiences that I've had. But it also allows me a broader view of the concerns that other people have, because even if I don't have those exact experiences, I understand the affect, I understand the intensity, I understand the fear,
yeah.
And I can use those pieces to animate how I serve.
Right. So the first office you ran for was state rep, correct?
Correct.
And so from state rep to, how did you experience that race gender prism when you were state rep versus now when you are Stacey Abrams of Georgia?
So the first time I ran for office, I ran in a district that was roughly half white, half African American. And all of my campaign literature didn't have my face on it because I couldn't afford all those, color cost money. So we had more simplistic pieces.
Sure.
But when I first started introducing myself to community, I went to visit a house in an African American part of town, and I knocked on the door, and the woman said, I said, "Hi, I'm Stacey Abrams." She said, "Stacey Abrams is a Jewish woman." I said, "No, ma'am, I'm Methodist." And she just kind of cocked her head at me, and she's like, "Well, what are you doing?" And then when I went to the other side of town, an older Jewish woman opened the door, and she's like, "I thought Stacey Abrams was Jewish." And she too looked disappointed. I'm like, "No, I'm a Black Methodist. I'm sorry." So even in my first run, their expectations of who would stand for the seat.
It would be
different.
A white woman.
It was a white woman.
Right.
And my predecessor in the seat, one had been an older Black woman, the other had been an older Black man. And I think they expected something different because of the composition of the district.
Sure.
When I stood for leader, I became the first woman to lead a party in the history of the state of Georgia. I was the first Black person to lead in the House.
Right.
And thus I was the first Black woman to do any of this stuff.
Sure.
And that became apparent sometimes in the way I had to negotiate, because I'm working with people who've never had to have conversations about power with someone who looked like me.
Right.
They didn't know what they were doing, and I didn't know what I was doing.
Yeah.
My approach was to just admit it and confront it and say, okay, what do I need to do to get you to give me what I want?
And when you say that, is it making a disarming comment? Is it just being blunt about it?
It depended on the person.
Sure.
I mean, I'd gotten to know the Speaker of the House,
right,
when he served as chair of a committee I served on. And so he knew who I was. But the first time we had to navigate a thorny issue together, I went with blunt because he had seen me work. He knew my work ethic and the ethos I used to organize the work I did, and that worked. There were others who were just dumbfounded that I was the person sent to speak to them.
Right.
And sometimes I had to just charm them into forgetting why they were uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But sometimes it was drawing out of them what their discomfort was. Was it truly my race, or was it simply I was different?
Right.
And what that difference meant to them. Because some people disliked me because of race or gender. Some people just didn't like me because of who I was.
Yeah.
And my job was to figure out which one it was, because immutable characteristics I can do nothing about. The parts of me that cause you fear or panic or anger, if there are things I can I can adulterate to make it a little easier for us to work together, I will,
right,
if I agree with you.
Yeah.
And if I don't, we just have to work anyway.
I'm kind of curious how you think, going back to that prism of race, mm-hmm, and gender and policy issues and you and voters, how you think different groups perceive you. Let's say white women versus Black women, white men versus Black men. Like, I think you've written a little bit about Black women maybe being more upfront with you about concerns they have about your candidacies at various points. Like, do you think this is a white woman, she probably is coming with this understanding, yeah, of me?
Actually, one thing that was made very clear through my primary run was that because my opponent was a white woman,
yeah,
with the same name, similar resume, at least on the superficial levels, we were,
right,
both attorneys and legislators. What was disconcerting to me was actually finding out that the same challenges I had existed for all of those communities.
And what were they?
People were just concerned that a Black woman could do the job, whether,
right.
I mean, and it came from Black women, white men, Black men, Latina.
Right.
I mean, almost every combination you can imagine. When I reached out, someone from that community said, "Well, I think you're the most qualified. I think you've done a great job, but you're a Black woman." Right. As though they were giving me some kind of fatal diagnosis. I'm like, I know, I've met me.
Right.
But what I found is that it was less about me and more about how people perceive the combination of what I am.
The electability thing the we're electability. Talking about right now. Yeah.
And it's not endemic solely to the white community or the black community. It manifests itself because people position themselves through the worst lens they can imagine.
Right.
And sometimes it's because they're trying to look out for you, but more often they're trying to justify their own discomfort.
Right.
And that part is the hardest because it's what we discovered is that in our focus groups and our analysis, I picked up support from every one of those groups. I sit on planes today and mm-hmm. people come and say hi to me and I can't really tell based on what they look like, how they're going to react to me.
Sure.
I was in an airport in Utah and this guy in camouflage, this tall white guy in camouflage came up to me and I'm thinking, oh dear God, what is he going to say to me?
Right.
And he said, thank you. I'm so glad. He's like, thank you. I really enjoyed that speech you gave.
Yeah.
And it was both a moment for me of being happy and a reaffirmation that, yes, there are certain categories of community that are going to be disproportionately unlikely to like me.
Right.
But that I can't extract from any one person this larger narrative for everyone.
Yeah.
And my job isn't to try to figure that out. My job is to do my best work and to try to demystify what they're concerned about.
Right.
But what I can't fix, I can't fix, and I'm going to move on and just keep doing the work.
Yeah. I mean, I am curious about that gubernatorial primary race. As you said, you ran against another woman who was white, who was also named Stacy. I read a tidbit from a local columnist who said that the primary could have the feel of a feud between Beyonce and Taylor Swift. Did you expect the media coverage of your race to be what it turned into, which was...
You mean petty, reductive, and deeply misogynistic?
Did you expect that?
I wasn't surprised by it. I will say this. Even for the journalist who said that, I think the challenge was they'd never confronted having to navigate so many different pieces. So I will give them some benefit of the doubt, but not too much, because it was 2018.
Right.
And had the juxtaposition been two men named Michael, I doubt it would have been reduced to that facile a description
sure.
of the complexity of what was happening.
Right.
And so I do think that there was a laziness sometimes to how we were described and how we were covered. That there was also a dismissal of the legitimacy of the candidacy, because for a lot of these reporters, there were multiple reasons they didn't think I could win. And so the onus and the responsibility for a better treatment of the campaign and better coverage did not hold.
Yeah. What were do you think that those reporters were sort of mischaracterizing your, say, policy positions because of, say, okay, this is a black woman and therefore she's probably thinks this?
I think there was a combination of mischaracterization of myopia. I mean, they would focus on racially pertinent aspects with microscopic detail and ignored the larger point that was being made.
Such as what?
When I would talk about criminal justice reform is an example, but the one that was most pervasive was a conversation I had in response to Charlottesville.
Right.
My response was one that was grounded in a conversation about how we think about how each of us is situated in this state and how we need to confront nationalism and white supremacy and the dehumanization of others.
Right.
But it became this very, very hyper-simplistic conversation that never gave full weight to what I thought was a fairly complex issue and, in my mind, a fairly nuanced characterization. Now, I had a very absolutist goal, which is I don't like racism,
right.
But there were other pieces to it. But what happened was not simply the focus on that. It was a focus to the exclusion of everything else I talked about. And so while I was the only candidate with robust healthcare plans, with robust plans on criminal justice reform, on energy, we had reams of information, but I also had experience and a history I could point to for everything I talked about.
Yeah.
Everything came back to anything that had any racialized tone, that became the lead and the lens through which everything else was discussed.
I remember during that primary, there was a lot of talk about, you know, the idea of appealing to white suburban women in particular, right? And that was, and that a white woman candidate in the general election would be better able to appeal to those white suburban women. Do you think that that bore out in the general election? Do you think that there were white suburban women who maybe because of your race didn't give you a fair shake? Or
I think that's a fallacy that is perpetuated in part because we keep relitigating the last election.
The 2016 election.
Or in our case, the 2014 gubernatorial election. Sure. I achieved the highest turnout of white voters for Democrats in a generation. So no, it didn't, it wasn't borne out. But I also simultaneously increased every single metric of communities of color. And so what we demonstrated is that it is a fallacy to argue that in order to win this group of people, you have to either look like them or exclude another group.
Sure.
We centered communities of color, we talked to the marginalized, we competed everywhere and it worked. We increased our turnout rates astronomically. I've received more votes than any Democrat in Georgia history. And that was a function of the campaign we ran and a function of the candidate I was.
Yeah.
And my facility for being able to talk about issues that both a suburban white mom cared about and a suburban black mom and a suburban Latina mom.
Right. I want to ask about black men in that election.
Okay.
And I know you've had some things to say about, so there were the exit polls in the general election. I think you know what I'm asking you. It showed that probably more black men than expected, perhaps, voted for the Republican Brian Kemp.
That's untrue.
Okay.
So the exit polling had a fairly aggressive number, but if you actually look at the data from the election, once the numbers were in, there's always a higher percentage of black women than black men that vote Democratic, but the marginal difference was not notable. It was roughly equal to what it always is.
And there, so after the election, there was this kind of cycle of, are black men more sexist than we think? And you think that that's a fallacy?
I think it's a fallacy. Black men, particularly in the South, have tended to be more conservative. Mm-hmm. And there's always a gap, just as there's a gap between white men and white women. There's a tendency for women of both races to be more Democratic leaning. Sure. For black men, it is a number, it's a few points. It is not 10 points, 15 points.
Right.
It's a very marginal difference, but that has been borne out through, I think, every single electoral cycle.
Yeah.
But I will say this, my disconcertion with that conversation is that there is an attempt to place blame on a certain community as opposed to highlighting and illuminating all of the things we accomplished and understanding the role that suppression played writ large in an election.
Right.
Because the communities that are more likely to be affected by voter suppression are communities of color and particularly black men.
Right. One thing we've been asking women politicians in this project might seem like a trivial question to people, but it's about, you know, your visual public presentation, right? The idea that, I mean, I think women in general think about mm-hmm. this. I know I thought about what I was going to wear this morning.
Always.
But, you know, thinking about what clothes to wear, what photo ops to do. And I'm kind of curious, do you find yourself parsing through all that when you pick out what you're going to wear that morning or where you're going to go on the campaign trail?
Well, I had to develop a style. Mm-hmm. My style as a legislator was different. And I wore more pants and more blazers. But on the campaign trail, I needed to project an image that was sleeker than being in the state legislature in the middle of winter 3 months out of the year. And so I really had to figure out what my style would be. The fact that I was on my feet and on the road that whole time, I like dresses. So I started wearing more dresses. I found dresses that were flattering, that didn't wrinkle. Which is a key issue, because if you got to stand up and sit down and be in a van for hours or a bus for hours, you can't get out and
no
look
one's
like
steam you.
Exactly. But I also had to think about colors. I couldn't wear patterns because patterns don't show up as well. And I had to think about which color I wore because every color carried some meaning for someone.
Right.
Is she wearing chartreuse for a reason? Right. No, it's the color that was there and it was clean. It had come back from the dry cleaners that day. And so it was, yes, you have to think about it because it's not just about who I am. It's what people see. And I think it's disingenuous to believe that appearance doesn't matter. The issue, though, is how is appearance judged as a part of the whole and not as the sole marker of our effectiveness? And where women have been mistreated is that we are expected to look exactly the same and that we're expected to meet a certain model of perfection and a certain aspect of what people expect to see, and that I refuse. So
does it irritate you having to think, okay, I moved from the Georgia legislature and now I've raised profile, I have to think more or spend more or whatever to have a certain image?
Well, I wouldn't say it irritated me. I had to accept it because I was asking for a different job. And I think we do, as Americans, we have made certain that the way we present ourselves is a part of how we judge. I can't change that. Right. What I can change is that I'm not going to do what you think I should do. So I had a lot of people advising me on what my look should be and how I should present myself and what I needed to do and what I couldn't do. Those people annoyed me, and those offers of advice were politely rejected.
I want to ask another thing that, you know, one detail that struck me in your book is you write about how you guys did focus groups for how voters felt about a single woman running for governor. And just stripping away the world of politics where this stuff is so normal, how did it feel to you to ask strangers how they felt about your relationship status?
Luckily, I wasn't present for any of these things. However, people felt comfortable offering me their advice and their insights, whether I asked them or not.
Yeah.
So I had random people who would tell me what they thought about it. And I think there are two pieces to it. One is that people are trying to reassure themselves that there's not some secret behind it other than the fact that I'm just not that good at dating. Like, I've tried, and sometimes I'm good, sometimes not so much. I've been a little busy, so I've fallen behind on it.
Right.
But what they're asking is, do you share experiences with me that can help you serve me? So I get that. The ones that are judgmental because they're trying to figure out who I am and whether I'm worthy, those aren't legitimate, and those are the ones I reject. Luckily, though, I didn't have to send in any of these conversations. They let me watch the tape if I wanted to. I just read the report because, luckily, in the end, people didn't care that much.
Yeah. The judgment thing is interesting. I mean, you've written and talked a little bit about imposter syndrome, things like that. I mean, this isn't necessarily a pointed question, but...
You can point
it. Do you still deal with that? I mean, with imposter syndrome, or is that kind of a thing that you've grown out of in your political life?
I've been very intentional about giving myself credit for what I am and leaving space for me to become more and acknowledge what I'm not. And I think part of my opportunity and what I try to talk about in the book is that imposter syndrome often happens because we don't do that deep personal investigation. And we have to do it in a way that doesn't become navel-gazing. I've been very intentional for most of my adult life to judge where I am and make sure I'm there because of my merit, because of my effort, and to figure out what else it was. I believe in serendipity. If I get there because someone else decided to make it happen, what I have internalized is they may get me there, but I'm the only person who can keep me there.
Right.
And I think that helped me break the imposter syndrome sensibility.
You know, it's interesting. I think in the preface to your book, you call it the art of war for outsiders. I guess that's kind of like your advice to people women who might run for office is just to kind of shed it, recognize it, and shed the...
Absolutely. Yeah. It is natural. We have been socialized our entire lives. You're not going to shed that by sheer force of will. We have to be intentional about it. And part of what I wanted to do is say that part of that intentionality is acknowledging what it is, admitting how it feels, and then doing what you need to do to reject it anyway. But it takes practice. Like any other skill, you have to work to reject, you know, thousands of years of indoctrination about our values and our value.
Right. I want to go back to the Georgia governor race.
Sure. Let's go back there.
And specifically about a question you were asked again and again, and you kind of addressed it earlier, talking about electability, because people said, you know, is the state ready for a black woman? Is the country ready for a black woman? And I'm curious how you felt about that specific question. Was it an affront to you? Was it annoying? Did it become a stock question that you just developed a stock answer to?
I think it is a curiosity to people.
Right.
Because they're informing not only their sensibilities, but they're trying to prognosticate others. And when something new is on the horizon, we are usually both equally curious and afraid. Mm-hmm. Race and gender have such contextualized meaning in our society that I don't begrudge the question, mm-hmm. but I resent an answer that doesn't accept the wholeness of who I am. And that's why I was so careful about my response, that I'm electable if I win, and I'm electable because I can win. And what I stand for is not simply, I'm not solely an avatar, not simply, but I'm not solely an avatar for Black women, but I am a proud avatar of both of those things because it stands as an example to others of what's possible.
Yeah.
But we also have to recognize that electability is not simply a question of whether you have the capacity and if people want you, it's also whether the system will allow it to happen. And that's the other part of how I try to answer this question.
Yeah. You have a reputation for kind of being a pragmatic politician when it gets down to it. And, you know, Barack Obama is someone who had that kind of reputation. Do you think that that is in part informed by your race and wanting to...
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Race and gender.
Sure.
I mean, look, most of the things I want to do, no one who looks like me has ever done it before.
Yeah.
And most of the resources that make it possible are usually not immediately available.
Yeah.
Pragmatism is figuring out how you can make things happen despite not having full access, but also being reasonable and thoughtful about what's possible and what's not.
Right.
It doesn't mean I don't dream, but it means that I've learned to exercise my drive in a way that gets me where I need to be without too much idealism,
sure.
You know, clouding my judgment or confusing my ambition.
Sure. You are now the subject of pretty rampant running mate speculation. But a lot of times your name comes up in these conversations about the need to counterbalance a hypothetical white candidate, particularly mm-hmm. a white male candidate. And, you know, I'm curious, how do you feel about discussions that seem to kind of put your race and gender first and foremost?
I accept that I exist in the political zeitgeist in a very specific way, mm-hmm. and that we as a nation have very binary notions of politics. You're a Democrat or Republican, you're a man or a woman, you're Black or you're white, you are white or a person of color. We don't do a lot of nuance. And so often the reason the question is raised begins with that. Mm-hmm. But I think the reason the question is sustained is the story that lies behind it. I'm a very accomplished person who has experience on a realm of issues and has the capacity to do this job. And so while I may chafe a bit at what spawns the question, I'm very proud of why I'm even in the conversation, mm-hmm. because I'm not in the conversation just because I'm a Black woman. Mm-hmm. Those are two pieces that people use to lift up their intention, mm-hmm. but the whole of me is the reason I'm considered viable, and that's what I cling to, and my job is to make sure other people understand it.
So there's almost like a private personal reaction maybe and a public reaction that you have?
I'm pretty public about my private reaction, which is like I recognize why the conversation starts. But this is similar to the imposter syndrome. No matter why you put me there, no matter why you gave me entry, my job is to prove that I can stay there. Mm-hmm. My job is to take advantage of and deliver so that I can do even more. And I cannot worry myself with what limited notion led you to open the door, because my job is to kick the door open, take it off its hinges, and make sure other people can come in.
This is the question we've been ending on with people.
Yes, ma'am.
Do you think the country will elect a woman president in the next 20 years?
Yes, absolutely.
Do you think they'll elect a Black woman?
Yes, absolutely.
Do you think they'll elect you?
Yes, I do. That's my plan. And I'm very pragmatic.
Stacey Abrams, thank you so much for joining us.
Claire Malone, this has been delightful.
Yes.